Hi, I'm Orbert Davis, and welcome to the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Jazz Cast Series, where we sit down with music legends as well as rising stars to hear their stories. This monthly series is all about sharing experience and knowledge with you. Thanks for tuning in. For more, visit chicagojazzphilharmonic.org. Let's do it.
Dizzy Gillespie is one of the giants of jazz, who along with Charlie Parker developed the kind of music that became known as bebop. He has also experimented with many different styles to get his message across to audiences around the world. And the mark he has left on music is indelible. Dizzy. Well, I understand that, you know, throughout your career, you've introduced a lot of young people around, and I hear that today you have such a person who is a trumpeter who is, I hear you think is terrific. So yes. Please tell us something about him.
Well, this young man I heard first when he was about 14, I guess, in San Francisco. And he was, at that time, he was big for his age. Because he was up here at that time in 14, and his mother brought him to hear me play, and it seems that he had been collecting my records for as long as he'd been playing. And then I let him sit in, because I let him sit in, it was against the law. I shouldn't say that in the White House. But I let him sit in, and I was very impressed with his playing. And then we became friends. He came to New York. Now he's one of the top trumpeters in New York now. And I just like to say that I'm very proud of him. And that was the reason I asked him to come. And his name is John Faddis.
Right. Welcome, everybody. It is my, oh, wow. It's more than a privilege. It's an honor, and it's a thrill to be hanging out with John Faddis. Let's give him a camp virtual applause, standing ovation even. All right. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Orbert. It's good to be here with you.
Well, the first thing I have to ask you is when you whispered to Dizzy, what did you say?
I told him that you couldn't hear the mute in the audience when he's playing in muted, so we should play open.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Wow. Oh, man. There's so much to talk about in so little time. I guess the first thing, as Dizzy said, at the age of 14, you were already a virtuoso and studying Dizzy Gillespie. Why Dizzy?
My trumpet teacher that I got when I was about 10 years old, I'd been playing since I was 7. Then I got a different trumpet teacher at the music store. His name was Bill Catalano, and he's a trumpet player, played with Stan Kenton's band for a while, and used to play all the acts that came through town. Mm-hmm. So our first lesson, one of the things that he told me was, Dizzy Gillespie is the greatest trumpet player in the world. Oh. I was 10. So I said to myself, well, if he's the greatest, that's what I want to sound like. So I started collecting Dizzy Gillespie records. Yeah. And part of my lesson would be practicing sometimes just one measure of a Dizzy Gillespie solo, which would take me, you know, months to learn just one measure. It was so difficult.
Yeah.
And I just loved the fact that he had a sense of humor. I loved the fact that he had a different trumpet. I love the fact that his cheeks puffed up.
Yeah.
And I love the way he played the trumpet. So that was it for me.
Yeah. So I'm sure it was
a little bit later. I got into other trumpet players like Clifford and Louis Armstrong.
Mm-hmm. Of course. But I imagine that after practicing his solos and getting so into Diz, that an important thing for you was to see him live.
Absolutely. I had seen Louis Armstrong live. But I met Dizzy at 12. I played with him, actually. He said 14 on the White House tape. I was actually 15.
Okay.
And it was at the Jazz Workshop where no minors were allowed. But I had met him a few weeks prior to that at the Monterey Jazz Festival. And I brought about 55 albums for him to autograph. So I think that really shocked him, because at that time, which is about 1967, 68, about at that time, Dizzy wasn't as popular as he was in the 40s, and he wasn't as strong an influence on trumpet players as he was in the 40s. Because after the 40s, the 50s, you had the people that Dizzy taught,
right,
and they were making a name, and that's who young people emulated. People like Fats Navarro and Miles, and Kenny Dorham, and then a little later, Clifford Brown, and then Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw and Lee Morgan.
Yeah.
So I think he was really shocked to see a young trumpet player whip out 50-something Dizzy Gillespie records.
Nice.
And he would say, "I don't remember this one." And I'd say, "Yeah, that's what where your solo goes." And I'd sing his solo. And so he really looked at me like I was crazy.
Oh my God.
But when he let me sit in with his band in 1968 at the Jazz Workshop, he had Mike Longo, the late Mike Longo, on piano. Moody was there, James Moody. Candy Finch played drums, and bass player that just passed away from Philadelphia. Oh my gosh. But that was the group, Jimmy Merritt.
Yes.
And he called me up to sit in, and I played. Well, here's the story.
Okay.
He was playing A Night in Tunisia. My trumpet was in the basement in the dressing room. And he walked by the table, and I said, "Dizzy, you going to play the ending?" He said, "You got your horn, you do it."
Uh-oh.
So I ran down and got my horn, and I did it, and he called me up to play with the band, play Satin Doll. Then he called a tune that Jimmy Owens wrote called Get That Money Blues, which was on a record that had just come out called The Melody Lingers On. And so I think Dizzy liked the way I played, because what I played that night was his solo.
Oh, man.
From that record.
Wow.
So he heard it, and he looked. And I looked him up once I came to New York. I came to New York with Lionel Hampton's band. I looked Dizzy up, and we got together. And whenever he would play in a club or a concert, I would be there with my horn.
Yeah.
And that lasted about 20 years.
Wow. Wow.
So I got to stand next to the greatest trumpet player in the world for 20 years.
Wow. And you know what? I have to say this, John.
For that, for me, that was one of my goals, and it was a dream come true.
Yeah. And I have to say this. I feel the same way with you. Because I don't know if I've told you, when I first heard you, I lived in a small town south of Chicago, and the radio signal was very weak. And I had to put my little radio like at a certain angle to hear WBEZ late at night to hear jazz. And Dick Buckley played something from with you and Oscar Peterson from the from your Youngblood album. And I think it was Things to Come Things Ain't the Way They Used to Be or something. But I just felt like I wanted to put the trumpet down after I heard that. But then when I first heard John Fast on the radio, I was about 14, 15, and it just blew me away. We'll get a chance to hear a little bit of him playing. And I felt the same way with him with Dizzy. So when I was a student in college, he came to visit the school, and I'll never forget that first meeting. But one thing that's fascinating about John, and we'll talk about this, is his memory, and that he, unfortunately, I could play some of your solos from Youngblood, but down an octave, you know. So, but I think one thing that's fascinating with you with students is your memory. And all the encounters that we've had through the years, you always seem to take up the conversation that we left off 2 years ago. I don't know if you know that.
I don't remember.
But I do. But anyway, another thing, and I do want to get to the place where where the students can know more about you. We are, of course, talking about Dizzy. We can stay on Dizzy for a minute, though. You mentioned his humor, which was extraordinary. Did you find his humor to be spontaneous at all times, or was he more of like a comedian that was ready to have his stick, or was it just the moment?
Actually, both. There were times when he could be very spontaneous with an audience member. Mm-hmm. And there were times when he stuck with a routine. No matter where it was, he would be in Yugoslavia or something like that back then and do the same routine that he was doing in New York City. And people wouldn't understand one word of what he was saying.
Right.
But the band would be on stage cracking up.
Yeah.
I remember once one of the funniest things I ever saw Dizzy do from the stage is we were at Buddy Rich had a club in New York City. And this was about 1974, early 1974. And he had put together a big band with Billy Mitchell and Evie Perry and Rod Levitt, you know, Mickey Roker. So he put together this big band. I'm playing there. And it's a Saturday night, and someone in the audience had too much to drink. So Dizzy's, you know, doing his announcement, and then one guy in the audience yelled out, "It all started with Dizzy!" And Dizzy didn't like to be interrupted when he was in his routine, so Dizzy looked at him and said, "It all started with your mama."
Oh, no.
I don't know if I should say that, but it was just spontaneous, and the whole audience just broke up laughing.
Oh my goodness,
it was incredible. So,
wow!
I once asked Dizzy where he got the sense of timing for his entertaining an audience, and why he chose to entertain an audience, unlike Miles, and right. having that connection. And Dizzy said, "Well, I think I got that from Cab Calloway and Billy Eckstine."
Oh.
When he was with their band in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
And he just continued along those lines. He said, "Look, people are paying a lot of money to come and hear me, and they don't always have that money to spend. So I want them to have a good time."
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I can imagine in the 20 years that you were so closely tied to Dizzy, that you have many, many, many conversations. And a lot of them, of course, I know are very personal to you. But has it ever come up about his relationship with Louis Armstrong? Because a lot of times we hear about the conflict early and things that Louis said. And, you know, but then I showed the students last week, Umbrella Man, that where we saw that comedy.
Umbrella Man, of course.
Umbrella Man with on the Jackie Gleason show. So, do you have any stories about?
It's funny. Uh-huh. I did ask Dizzy once why he didn't say anything when the press would always proceed with the storyline that they hated each other.
Right.
They were actually neighbors. Dizzy lived right around the corner from Louis Armstrong, and Dizzy said, "Well, we just did. The truth will come out."
Mm.
You know, Dizzy, it's funny because Dizzy said he once went around the corner to see Louis Armstrong on the 4th of July, which was then celebrated as Louis Armstrong's birthday.
Right.
And he went in and, "Come on in, Diz, hold up, wait right here." And Louis Armstrong went in the back and brought out a gift wrapped gift for Dizzy on Louis Armstrong's birthday, and that knocked Dizzy out.
Oh, wow.
He thought that was one of the most beautiful things that someone had ever done. And wow. Clark Terry was also a neighbor in Corona, Queens of Louis Armstrong. So he said he and Dizzy would go by and get their batteries charged, and Louis Armstrong would say, "Come on in and let me tell you the story of this music."
Mm.
So Dizzy, I think, felt that the truth would come out. And he said that Louis Armstrong and he loved each other, and that he felt that Louis Armstrong respected his playing.
Right. Wow. That's awesome. So one of the important things.
Let me just say, let me just say this, Orbit.
Sure.
Because we know how the press will often pit black males against each other.
Mm-hmm.
It still goes on today.
Right.
Even though they may have an appreciation and love each other. So I think a lot of that is part of that racist narrative that comes down.
Thank you. Yeah, that's awesome. We know through history that one of the important things that Dizzy did was his ambassadorship to Cuba. And we're just so fortunate to have our Cuban students joining us all the way from Havana and Matanzas. So let's, Dizzy tells the story best in this clip. So let's watch this clip of Dizzy Gillespie in Cuba.
The two little wooden sticks, that is a clave, and they have a specific beat, like ping, 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 ping. I was very much inspired by the music of Cuba. But there weren't any of those African rhythms around in jazz. So the organization of my first big band, I immediately contacted Mario Bowser to see if he'd get me a drummer. And he introduced me to Chano Pozo. And from that moment on, it was chicken butts. Somebody asked Chano, said, how do you communicate with Dizzy when you don't speak English and he doesn't speak Spanish?
And how did you communicate?
Chano says, Dixie, no piki English, no don't piki pani, me no piki English, but both speak African. Heritage in the United States. It is mostly white heritage. They don't dwell too much on our heritage, the black heritage. So we have to do it ourselves. So I think it's necessary for our children to know from whence they had come and where they're going. Thank you.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. And we think about just Dizzy and what that collaboration meant and did for jazz history and American music history. It's phenomenal.
Well, Dizzy was a section mate of Mario Bowser's in Cab Calloway's orchestra. And Mario Bowser is the guy who taught himself how to play the trumpet in 2 weeks and recorded a great solo on a tune called Tanga with Machito's band. Dizzy didn't, with me, he didn't talk so much about Chano, but I know they had a very deep relationship. Mm-hmm. And I know that Dizzy, like when he would sing Swing Low Sweet Cadillac, he put the I think it's a chant that Chano used to do on Cubano B, Cubano Bop. Dizzy took that and put it on the beginning of Swing Low Sweet Cadillac. Mm-hmm. And one of the things Dizzy always said, that he was a rhythm man. That meant rhythm to him was one of the most important elements of jazz. And that there are not so many people that were hip to rhythm. Now, in the video, you could see Dizzy dancing.
Yeah.
And he pulled a young lady out from the audience. He danced with her. Dizzy loved to dance. He told me that one night he was on the road with his big band. And he was on tour with Ella Fitzgerald, who was with his band. Mm. He looked out in the audience and said, "Man, these people can't dance." He grabbed Ella. They went out on the dance floor. And it happened to be a dance contest. And they won the dance contest.
Wow, that's amazing.
So the rhythms that Chano Pozo was showing to Dizzy, after Chano Pozo passed away, he transferred some of those rhythms to the drum set. Oh. You know, the jazz drum set.
Yeah.
So the 6/8 beat that you hear Charlie Persip, Art Blakey do, that came from Chano Pozo.
Mm-hmm.
Through Dizzy.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, when Dizzy would travel, he wanted to hear local musicians. He wouldn't always play because he felt that could embarrass, you know, another trumpet player or another musician. But mm-hmm. he was there to check out the rhythm. And I know that I think Chano Pozo passed away in 49. And 8 years later, Dizzy was doing a State Department tour. He went down to South America. And that's where he heard and met a young composer pianist by the name of Lalo Schifrin.
Yes.
So when he heard Lalo, he said, "Man, come to New York." Lalo got scared. He thought, "Is he kidding? This is Dizzy Gillespie. What's he want with me?"
Mm-hmm.
Came to New York and he said, because this is an example of Dizzy, or the example of the teacher being influenced by the student.
Wow.
Miles Davis in 1957, 58 had done Sketches of Spain.
Right.
And Dizzy heard that and he loved it. And he told Lalo, "I want you to write something for me like that." So Lalo said, "I'm hearing a brass band, 4 trumpets, 4 trombones, 4 French horns, no saxophone in the section, tuba, and Latin percussion, and jazz quintet." And that's when he wrote Gillespiana for Dizzy. And some of that playing on there is extraordinary. Especially, you know, when we perform, you know, Orbit, you perform Sketches of Spain and you've done that live. Different experience than hearing it on the record.
Yeah, it is.
And it really goes down into your body and affects you. So there's a movement in Gillespiana called Africana,
mm-hmm.
where it has some African things. And I heard, you know, I was doing, when I had the band at Carnegie Hall, we did that. And when I heard just the rhythm vamp, I started crying. I started crying. I couldn't believe it was live.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe I was playing Dizzy's part.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's rhythm aside, you know, when Dizzy is another thing that your students might not know about Dizzy. When Dizzy, he would think of a rhythm first and how he wanted the rhythm to fit into a particular phrase. And then he would put the notes to it.
Mm.
And he'd do that because he had such a great sense of harmony as well.
Right.
And he attributes that to one thing, the piano.
Mm.
So for all the students, if you have the opportunity and you're a horn player or bass player, drum, learn the piano.
Wow. Great advice. So one thing that Dizzy said when he introduced you at the White House as being one of the great young trumpet players, I think many people don't know, except those who were like me when I was young. I read the back of album covers like nobody's business. And the name that just came up time after time after time, day, minute after minute, was John Faddis. So you were one of the top musicians in history to record. What kind of work did you do?
I did jingles. I did recording sessions and a few film sessions.
Mm-hmm.
I came in at the tail end of an era where it would be a recording session and there would be a big band. And I came at the tail end. I got on a few sessions where Ernie Royal was there, Joe Newman was there, Clark Terry was there, yeah. Or Snooky Young was there.
Wow.
That was sort of a normal thing in the 60s. You walk into a session and there's Ernie Royal and Bernie Glow and Snooky Young and Joe Newman or Clark Terry. And you look up and Oliver Nelson or Thad Jones or somebody like that is writing Quincy Jones. Mm. So when I started recording, it was mainly due to Lou Soloff introducing me to musicians around the scene.
Sure.
And as many of you know, Lou Soloff was a trumpet player for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, amongst many other things that he would rather one speak about than Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Mainly Gil Evans Orchestra, Thad Jones, Mel Lewis.
Yeah.
But some of the sessions that I did were for some big names. There would be like people like James Brown or Aretha Franklin or Luther Vandross, things like that, you know. And the way, you know, when I was young, you talked about reading liner notes. Can't do that now. That print is too small on the CDs. Try to look at the liner notes. It's very small print. And that's right. One of the things that we don't have from streaming album. So you may have thousands of records, but you don't even know who's playing in the rhythm section.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that. So, excuse me.
Wow.
And so recording work was something I did. Because when I did those albums that you mentioned earlier, the Young Blood and the Oscar Peterson, John Faddis record, those were in the 1975, 1976. And Norman Grant, who was the manager of Oscar Peterson and Ella Fitzgerald, said to me, put together a group. I will take you on the road. And I felt too much pressure as being the next Dizzy Gillespie. So I
really
sort of retreated into the studio work. And it took, I think it took Wynton coming to town. That's what I want to do. I want to have a jazz group and go out on the road.
Yeah.
So I wasn't afraid anymore. I put together a group with Greg Osby and James Williams and Kenny Washington. Started going on the road.
Wow. Was that Into the Fatosphere or Taranga?
Oh, that was way before Into the Fatosphere. It's more about the time I did Legacy.
Legacy, okay.
The one that had Louis Armstrong's West End Blues on it.
Right.
And Little Jazz from Roy Eldridge and Charles Horn from Thad Jones. That record. That was early 80s.
Got it. So you mentioned Wynton Marsalis. We do have a clip of you and Wynton playing Things to Come. And this is phenomenal. So let's play that now.
Now, if you and your cat can put down something hard like that, we might admit you to the Heavenly Society of Musicians and Composers. Hold tight, Bucky, old boy. You ain't heard nothing yet.
So I spoke too soon. That was actually Dizzy conducting and playing on Things to Come, one of his compositions in 1946. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Would you consider that the height of Dizzy's career in reflection of what you said earlier?
No.
No.
No, 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 no. I mean, the things he did with Charlie Parker, yes. But as a trumpet player, I think Dizzy's best period was between 1954 and maybe 1965 or so.
Yeah.
And that's when it seemed like anything that he thought of, he could play.
Yeah.
Kiko O'Farrell wrote an album for Dizzy called The Manteca Suite.
Yes.
And It's just unbelievable when you try to play those things. Mm. I'll quote Wynton again. But Wynton speaking about Louis Armstrong, he would say, it sounds simple until you try to do it. You know, it sounds easy. It's very simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
Dizzy's style, a little bit more rhythmically complicated, a little bit busier. But since I had been listening to Dizzy for so long, you know, I can almost imagine, sometimes I look at a video that I haven't seen and he's going to play an E here, and he does it. He's going to go upstairs, and that's what he's going to do. But his style was so complex compared to other is not. I think it's a combination of the harmony and definitely the rhythmic aspect, mm-hmm. which a lot of trumpet players aren't as rhythmic as Dizzy. So because of that, I think a lot of other trumpet players are easier to follow and easier to listen to. It could almost be like a comparison with Sonny Rollins and John Coltrane.
Okay.
You know, a lot more rhythmic in his improvisations. And Coltrane was just flowing. He's all through. But there aren't too many. You see tons of tenor saxophonists playing like John Coltrane now. Mm-hmm. You don't see tons of them that have gotten next to that rhythm that Sonny Rollins was laying down.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
And I think that's,
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So, Albert, I do have one student question here.
Okay.
You want to get that in?
Let's get the question in, see if we can find it.
Okay, so this question is from Jordan Warren. It's kind of a unique question, John and Orbert.
Mm-hmm.
So Jordan says, he said, there's a fine line between a lot of things, but what is the line between advanced musician and professional musician? And what is the differences between being a pro and a legend.
Okay, I'm glad John gets to answer that one.
I'm glad Orbit can do that one.
I would say, okay, this is what John would say to me, is just keep practicing, you know, and don't worry about it. You just got to take day to day and do your best, you know, because I mean, and that's a question too, like, John, do you ever like look at your own yourself and say, I'm a pro? Yeah.
No. I don't think like that. It is important to keep practicing. But the one thing I would say is don't worry so much about labels, about whether you're advanced, about whether you're pro.
Yeah.
That takes place on the bandstand. If you can play, you're welcome on the bandstand. If you're welcome on the bandstand, you're a pro.
Wow. Wow. That makes sense. Okay, we have the video and we are ready. Here we go. I should have mentioned the composition. So it's John and Wynton playing Things to Come. That's an interesting. So what are the thoughts going through your mind, John, when you hear yourself and see yourself now?
I would say, oh, that was a pretty good night I had that day. with most look at something like that as a competition.
Yeah.
The way that I feel about that is that we are two different trumpet stylist. It's like vanilla and chocolate ice cream, or strawberry ice cream and raspberry swirl, or something like that.
I hear you.
You know, and the important thing is for young musicians not to say, oh, this one's better than this one, or this one's better than this one. It's to say, I appreciate each one of them for what they are doing.
That's awesome. And that's a great lesson to learn by. So, man, I could go for another hour, John, and we have to do this again. It's funny. Every time I see you, I always say I want to get you and do an interview. But I do have to thank you so much for at the Gen Conference. One of the things that I didn't mention.
Bria.
For introducing me to Bria Schoenberg. And and we interviewed her. She and I are friends. We got a chance to play together on the interview. And I think
she's something.
Oh man, just amazing. But you are a connector. You are our guru. And even though I look older than you at this moment, I'm actually going to shave this because of seeing myself sitting next to you. And
I shaved this morning just because of that same issue.
Anyway,
Thank you. We got one more question. This is from Annabelle. She's from Havana, and she's in Spain right now.
Annabelle.
She asked, John, did you play Dizzy and other favorite musicians' renditions of their solos in your concerts?
Sometimes I never know what I'll do at a concert. So it depends on what the theme of the concert is, what my reading of the audience is. Sometimes I will play something from Louis Armstrong and Roy Eldridge. Yeah. Sometimes I'll play something, you know, depend if sometimes when I go and travel, I'm playing with a different rhythm section.
Yeah.
I'll play a lot of Miles. I said, let's do all blues. Let's do Someday My Prince Will Come. And then, you know, because they know that more than they know Dizzy's music. Oh. If I say, okay, let's play Dizzy Gillespie, but I want the groove from the recording he did with the Double Six of Paris. And then look at me, they won't know what I'm talking about.
Right.
But Seven Steps to Heaven, those things like Miles, yeah.
All right.
Leslie also says her lips got numb while she was watching you play that solo just now. And and she wants to know if that was Dan Nimmer on the piano in that last piece.
No, I know it was Dan Nimmer. I was just saying that's Dan Nimmer on piano.
Yeah. I remember, I remember the drummer, Ali Jackson. I remember Carlos Enriquez on the bass. It might have been Dan. I don't recall.
Sure. All right. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately. And again, John Faddis, thank you so much. I will never forget this moment. I appreciate you coming on and giving our students so much wisdom. And we hope that everything will get better. And I'll see you again very soon.
Thank you. Pleasure.
All right.
Kids, learn that piano. maybe one quick story.
Go ahead.
One quick story.
Go ahead.
James Moody was in his 60s and he said to Dizzy, man, I wish I played the piano so I could understand those things you were telling me about in the 40s. And Dizzy looked at Moody and said, you're not dead.
That concludes this episode of the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Jazz Cast Series. We really appreciate you tuning in. Sharing these stories wouldn't be possible without the support of listeners like you. To hear previous episodes, or to make a donation, or to simply learn more about our mission, please visit us at chicagojazzphilharmonic.org. See you next time on the Chicago Jazz Philharmonic Conversation Series.